Unreserved Immigrant is a podcast that explores life as an immigrant in a foreign country. We explore the role of culture, work, and family as it relates to identity. Our guests range from founders, home executives, medical professionals, construction workers, musicians, maids, corporate specialists, and so forth. Unreserved Immigrant is a Sniper Wolf production.
So what do you think of, I'm a parent, so I'm always like looking at ways to be a better parent. So you don't resent the fact that they kept you from this truth?
I appreciate that they did, because as a child, I had a very good emotionally intelligence quota. I could see things and I would worry. I was quite intelligent. If my parents were to tell me, oh, it's happening again, or if I caught wind of it, I would want to be strong for my parents. And I think my parents' only purpose at that time was one, for me not to get traumatized, because this will affect you for life, and to give me a normal childhood as they could in that time. Because as a child, that's all I needed to worry about, is being a child and not try to be strong for my parents. So I'm eternally grateful for that, super grateful, because had I been aware that people sleeping on the street are actually dead people, this would have traumatized me forever. I only discovered this in therapy. And if I had been aware of that, I didn't come out unscarred, but it could have been so much worse. I could have had extreme post-traumatic stress.
Because there is always that thing where, like, do you hide the truth, the ugly truth from your kids, or do you let your kids know the ugly truth? And I've always felt like it's a bit irresponsible loading children with things that we can't carry. I mean, whatever that ugly truth is, you're suffering from it as an adult. So how much more a child who doesn't even have the emotional intelligence to piece why? What is the next chapter after this little paradise of yours?
The rebels found us. The rebels are scouring through the whole Congo. They're scouring through the jungle. They're trying to find opponents, and they're shooting everyone. And on their little trip, because as we are fleeing, they are chasing as well, you know. On their little trip, they found this village. We started hearing rumors of rebels. We started hearing helicopters above us. If you'd go like maybe a bit far from the village, you started seeing bullet casings. So you're starting to get a sense like, okay, it's starting, like they're starting to invade our little, yeah, it's not safe anymore. And the longer that we stay here, something's going to happen. And, you know, because they had sophisticated weaponry now, they had these choppers that they could easily see what is happening. It was easy for them to just drop grenades or whatever weapons they could, just to bomb up houses. My parents decided it was time to get out, and get out we did. It was time to continue the journey to the DRC. I think, quite frankly, had our little village not been discovered, I think we could have stayed there for the remainder of the war, because it was quite safe and we were self-sustaining. We had animals.
You said you were separated by this mighty river. So how do you get to the DRC?
Ideally, today, it takes less than 4 minutes to get to the DRC. Crossing the river by speedboat, it's quite easy to do so. But we had to walk right around the perimeter, which is why it took so long. We didn't cross the river. We had to walk right around the perimeter because it's dangerous to cross the river if you don't have a boat.
Okay.
You will die. It's suicide. So we had to go right around the perimeter, which it's such a long time. Because, I mean, if you had just crossed the river, if we had found a boat, this is easily 10-5 minutes. But because you're going all around, we finally got to the DRC, and our safe haven was the United Nations refugee camps.
And this is you, the refugees are mostly people from the Congo.
Mostly people from the Congo. But remember, at the same time, the Ugandan war is happening. At the same time, there's instability in the DRC in itself, in the south of the DRC. So the majority is from the Congo, but there are other nationalities, because there are instability in most of these countries. So we're all trying to flee. So the common thing we had was we're all going through war and we speak a common tongue.
And what were the conditions like at this camp?
I did not like this one, but because I remember this quite clearly, I did not like the refugee camp at all. I quite prefer the village. I was much happier. I found the camp to be overpopulated. I met a whole bunch of people. I felt like I was being thrown as a child. It felt like being lost in a shopping mall. I think that's what I could describe it as.
Mm.
It was just too many people. It was hot. I didn't know the languages they were speaking. It wasn't good for me, at least. I don't know how it could have been for my parents. But the good thing about this tent, is that you could register yourself as a refugee. And once you register yourself as a refugee, this was a good way for family to find you. So people would receive letters, get sent to this refugee camp. My dad would constantly send letters and our pictures to UN in the Congo, hoping that somebody from my family is looking for us, just trying to get information as much as possible. What I remember in this tent as well was that people would fake their ages because they didn't want to get vaccinated, because the UN would vaccinate the kids because there was cholera and there was everything, which was all good. The only problem is that when you get vaccinated, there's a period where your immune system is not the best. You're going to get sick. And you don't want a sickly child with you as you are going through war. So that's where people will change their ages and be like, oh, no, my child's much older. My child's been vaccinated. We don't need to vaccinate my child. Only because you don't want a sickly child.
I didn't think of the stuff, the details of it, of being in a... Yeah, in a place like that. Okay, and you get on this list hoping that someone will find you.
Yeah, and then after I don't know how long, after a few bribes were paid, finally my dad got word that my mom's younger sister and my mom's family is actually looking for us.
Wow, what a day.
And they sent our picture and they were like, yes, this is us. They're looking for us. And with a long letter saying that, which, you know, there were rumors that the war was over, but people were a bit skeptical of it. But then this letter said that the war is over. We're looking for you. Please take a boat. I will be at the port every single day waiting for you if you do come. This was my mom's younger sister and my mom's brothers. So that's what we did. My dad decided to take the chance. You know, this could have also been a hoax. This could have been someone else. This could have been a trap. We didn't really know if war was over. It was declared that war was over, really over. So my dad decided to take a chance. My dad decided he's going to have faith in the family after a few back and forth. Maybe code words only my aunt would know. Maybe references of things that only she would know. After, remember, once a letter is sent, you don't get it immediately back. You have to wait maybe another month for it. Maybe even though the letter is sent back immediately, it's not always given to you on time, or it's in between thousands of letters. So my mom sold the last of what she had. We got onto this boat, and this boat was full of every dirty thing you can think of. It is filled with livestock.
It was Noah's boat.
It was Noah's ark. It was just a mess. Every and anyone was welcome. People that were dying of cholera, people that had leprosy if they had it. Everything was just really bad. But we took the chance, we got onto the boat. And also, the risk with getting on the boat, which happened to my dad's brother, is that if you're caught on the boat by soldiers and the soldiers identify you as being a rebel, we don't even know how they identify you. They would then throw you in the container with the other rebels and drop you in the ocean. This identifying thing. So maybe if your nose was smaller or bigger, I don't know how they identify you. They identify my dad's brother as being a rebel. And he was thrown in a container.
Do you know if your dad saw this or if he heard? Do you know if they were in the same boat?
We also know this. He was taken away from us as a group.
Gosh.
This is my parents begging. No, he's not. He's not. And this is them threatening my family and saying that, oh, are you agreeing that you're part of me? It happened to many families. My dad had, I don't know how my dad got out of that situation. Maybe he told them he could work for them or whatever.
Asante, I just want to ask, how different did your dad and your brother and his brother look?
My dad is much shorter than his brother. My dad's brother, he's very outgoing in terms of he'll stand up for himself.
Yes. Yeah. So he represented strength and they just weren't put off by that, you know?
Yeah. It could have been. I don't know. Maybe if the soldier was maybe grabbing onto my mom inappropriately, knowing my dad's brother, you'd be like, don't do that. You can't do that. They'd be like, oh, you want to show us that you're strong? Yeah, you look like a rebel. Get into that.
So any and every reason. So it's not even. It isn't even. Okay, I get it.
People from the South were rebels and people from the South are much darker and their surnames don't have an H. That's where it started. But to be honest, it was just any excuse you could use, to be honest. You could say, oh, that man looked at me funny. I saw him during the war fighting for the other side. There's no way to prove this, but because we're going to believe the soldier and not the common man.
And then you finally get to the other side.
And people are being welcomed. The livestock has been taken off the boats, whatever. We're just there standing, trying to find any of the family members. We don't know if they survived. And then we spotted my mom's sister and my mom's brother.
Mm.
They escaped the war, so they looked fine and they were dressed properly. And that was a reunion. My parents were sobbing. Everyone was just sobbing.
Wow.
My mom's sister and mom's sister every single day and my brother every odd day or so. But my mom's younger sister never, every single day after the war was over, went to the ports and stayed for a while in case today might be the day that we're going to be there. And luckily, one of those days, we were there. She never gave up.
And this was before she'd received a letter to say, yes, they're there.
Yes, this is way before. She just had hope. My mom's brothers, they got a huge vehicle and then they went to our village where we stayed. And we're like, we're looking for this family. Do you know them? First used to be their house. And people from the village which had survived said, oh no, that family flew a long time ago. So they knew that, oh, so they fled. So maybe they could be alive or maybe they got caught on the way. But yeah, they came to us. They had so much supplies because they knew my mom must have given birth by now. But then they had just missed us. So they still had that hope. Okay, if they made it to the village, maybe, just maybe they made it to the refugee camp.
And yeah. Do you know anything now about your house?
Our house still stands. Our house got taken over by people in the neighborhood. So what happened immediately after war was the victory was declared by the rebels immediately after that. If you find a house, it was unclaimed, it was unoccupied, and you declare that this is your house, you immediately go register this house and this plot of land as yours. And technically, you have no one fighting for this because the rightful occupants of that house are fleeing the war.
Okay, did you claim this house by buying this house? Or you claimed it
No. You can just say, this was my house during the war. I lost my papers, but now I'm registering this house as mine. And because there's no one fighting you for this house, it's automatically yours. Because what's the government going to say? Oh, no, we don't have any records of this house anymore.
And now do you know the people living in your house?
It's probably been smoked many times. The only thing we know for a fact is ours was a swing set that my granddad made me because I was his first grandchild, which is engraved in my name. It says my name.
Which ought to serve as proof.
But no, because they registered it on time, what more can we do? They are the rightful owners, and that's what happened to many of our properties and many of other people's properties. Whoever was there on time and had no one contesting this, I think there was maybe a grace period of anyone contesting this. You were just allocated the title deed, and that was your house.
Now, safely, beautifully reunited with family.
In the Congo.
What district was this?
We crossed back into the capital city. So we stayed with the extended family for a while. But then because in the African culture, it's not like really okay for a man to live with his in-laws. Because we had such good diplomatic relations with Russia, a lot of Congolese young people were given scholarships to go and study like medicine and the skills in Russia and Cuba. So my dad organized that. This was way before war. My dad had organized that his little brother go to Russia and also following his footsteps of medicine. He was there throughout the war. He wasn't affected. He lived a good life in Russia. But then he moved back to the Congo to set up his life. He was very affluent. He lived in the mother city. And he invited my dad over to live with him because it's easier for my dad to live with his brother than to live with his in-laws. So we stayed with him. He didn't have a wife or children. He had a big enough house. So we stayed with him. It was me, my little brother, my mom, my dad, our helper, and my uncle. To survive as a husband, because my parents wanted to be independent, my mom sold clothing with a loan that she got from her brother-in-law. My dad did odd jobs here and there. My dad didn't go back into medicine yet. He did odd jobs here and there because he was trying to get back his papers and restart whatever to prove that he was a scientist and all this. So once he got his papers, he went back into the capital city because that's where he wanted to live and that's where he wanted to raise his family. He went back there. He started working as a lecturer in one of the universities, part-time lecturer, and I think he had his own business, not really sure. I think he consulted or something. He went back into that city and he stayed there for a few months and then he invited his family back. So that's his wife and his two children. We went back and so we went to go live with him and yeah, we lived happily ever after.
Except at some point you decided that was not good enough and you would be leaving to come to
It was good. It was really good. But then my parents decided, because, you know, after war, a country has to rebuild itself. And when we're rebuilding it ourselves, our priority is not the best schools. It's not the best hospital. Our priority is just to get a school, just to get teachers reacclimated, just to get students, just to get the society running, right? And my dad really believed in education for himself, for his children. And he felt that because we were so traumatized, we felt like his children deserved a break, you know, not to be in that environment, to be in a more stable society. Now, I remember back then, this was very early 2000s, maybe 2001. Black people in South Africa were really doing good for themselves. Employment equity has just been set up in South Africa. So if you were educated back then and you had the right connections, you could get a decent job. Mm. And also because, funny enough, my dad actually worked with the South African government. My dad used to liaise with the people from, I think it's called CIS or something, I just can't remember. It was a branch of the ANC, well, they were rebels in South Africa, but they used to find refuge in other parts of African countries. And my dad used to help them in terms of giving them books, because I know the South African students weren't given the best books here. So my dad used to donate quite a bit of books and all that. And he had some connections with people that were now in government in South Africa. And because of that, my mom's brother was sent to South Africa to study law at UCT and he was able to get a good job after that. And with a few friends my dad had made, my mom's brother got a very good job here in South Africa, got a wife. And my dad asked him, would it be okay if my child could come over there? Initially, it was just for a year, just to resettle and to learn English and to have a normal, wild child. So I came here for a while. I stayed for a very long time.
Okay, so when you came here, how old were you?
I was a baby. I was in primary school. I was a baby.
And your brother didn't come? School.
no, because my brother was way too young. My brother was way too young. My mom needed to be there for him. My mom just wanted to be close to her children.
And especially her girl child.
Which is why I actually went back. This was during primary school. I went back to the Congo. My mom really wanted to be with me. But living with my uncle's wife wasn't as rosy as it should have been. My mom took me back and I stayed with my parents for a while, but then it was so difficult for me to get back into the swing of things there, because when I came to South Africa, for some odd reason, they put me in an Afrikaans school, in Afrikaans classes, and that's where I started speaking Afrikaans, English second language. So when I went back to the Congo, speaking French first language, Portuguese second language, it was a lot. I couldn't get back into that. My mom decided that she would come back with me and live with me for about 6 months. My mom left my brother with her sister in the Congo. And then my dad was just working. My mom came to South Africa, lived with me for about 6 months. And I think that was very important because I was just hitting puberty. And it is a very crucial part in a girl's life. And I think a girl needs a mom at that point. So my mom stayed with me for a while. But then it turns out my mom was pregnant. With number three, my dad was like, well, I need to be with my child. My mom gives birth to number three. And then my mom goes back to the Congo to raise number three with my dad. So I stayed in South Africa, lived life at normal. I lived in Cape Town, in Maitland in particular. I had what you would call a very normal childhood. I went to very good schools.
So which languages do you now speak?
So I now speak English, French, Portuguese, Kituba, Afrikaans.
How do you think this experience has shaped you? Because as I was listening, I was thinking to myself, I cannot wait to actually talk to your dad, even if, like, maybe it's not on this podcast, but on the phone, just talking to him human to human. There is no way your dad sees people the same way that I see people, because he's experienced people at a level that I can't even imagine. When you haven't experienced things like war, you have such an optimistic view of what it is to be human. But your dad knows that the person you lie next to can kill you tomorrow.
I think my dad has experienced the most savage of human qualities to the kindest of human qualities. Full spectrum, my dad has seen how somebody's head can be chopped off for giving somebody a dirty look, or a baby being slaughtered in front of his eyes or ripped from a mother's stomach. And at the same time, he's experienced the kindness of people helping his wife give birth or offering his child bread when they had nothing. I think he's experienced both.
So how do you feel like this has shaped you?
If it weren't for my dad and for a whole bunch of therapy, I was traveling one time. Because again, I grew up very spoiled, and I think I am still spoiled. And I think that stems from the fact that my parents trying to make up for what I went through in life. So they tend to be lenient with me. But here's an example. I was going home one year, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 years ago. I was actually at the international airport in Ethiopia because I had a connecting flight there. It's a very nice airport, very modern. But then I saw on the corner a bunch of Somali women. They didn't look like they bathed, and they were sitting on the floor and they were eating what looked like, it didn't look like it was healthy or anything. And I remember being on the phone with my dad. I was like, oh, my dad, that is so gross. Like, how can they, like, just be sitting on the floor and eating out of pots? I was like, oh, my goodness, that is it. Because I am properly dressed. I have money. I have whatever. And that was my first reaction, was like, this is gross. This is not cool. And then my dad brought me back to earth. And my dad was like, that was us once upon a time. All these people they've ever known in their lives was war. And how lucky are they that they're getting transported by airplanes? We would have killed for us to be lifted by proper airlines and to even have a pot to eat out of. My dad's like, what you forget is what some people in the world and in neighboring countries, all they've ever known in their lives is war. And we have to be patient on how we treat these people, because people are traumatized. people are living on the constant edge. I mean, it's not normal for my parents still, like, we live in a stable country, like, to still have that bag in case something happens, you know? People are still living on edge. So I think I've really learned a whole bunch of empathy from my dad, a whole bunch of empathy. And what I didn't learn from him, I learned in therapy, because I know my dad didn't go to like, normal therapy like we go to in the West. I think his therapy, speaking about it and helping people.
And I think that takeaway is like the perfect way to end this podcast, because when I started Unreserved Immigrant, my whole intention was to build empathy around what it means to be an immigrant, to put a voice.
Honestly, Pumza, no one, I was quite happy back home when I hear stories of like my parents, like, they're living their happy marriage where they just got together. And when I see photographs, nobody wants to leave their home. Nobody thinks it's much better elsewhere. Like I said, I was so happy in that village. Things were good. No one wants to be displaced. No one wants to be feel less than human. And then you come to a country where you can't even communicate, but then you look down upon because your clothing are not proper, because you haven't taken a shower. And I became the person that was judging. I mean, I would see like the refugees camping outside in town, sitting on the floor, eating from the floor. And I think to myself, have some dignity. But then I realized this is...
That's so Western. That is such a Western.
No one chooses this.
But that's how I think we are. And I really want people to see and know that these people are people. I see myself in every single person that I speak to, because all the themes are the same. I think especially for someone who comes from an African country, I think we ought to display more empathy because we don't have the most stable countries. Even South Africa can go down so easily.
You know what's so funny is to think that, oh, I have money, it won't happen. Money meant nothing when war was happening. Like, it is nothing. You can't give me money.
Like, I'm looking at my fossil watch. I don't even know how far that will take me.
Probably a loaf of bread, if you're lucky.
Yes.
But all the money in your bank account will not buy you a plane ticket if planes are grounded by missiles. At the end of the day, you just realize all the things that you accumulate in life as well. Because this is my dad's second war. This is my dad's third time rebuilding his life. So everything that you accumulate are just things. They are literally just things. And it teaches you not to be so attached to things that, oh my goodness, my car, my laptop, and all these things. At the end of the day, what's really important is food and people. That's all.
Food, people, and kindness. That is my takeaway today. And that is exactly what I'm about to have. I'm about to have my lunch and I'm going to be kind and I'm going to sit with a bunch of people I love. I think Asante means, isn't it gratitude?
To be thankful. So on my business figure, it's Jessica and everything. It's always simple. When I got to the village, a child's name needs to have a value. So everyone called me Asante.
Okay.
And no one knew this. So then my grannies and people around were like, okay, Asante, Asante. And that's what I'm called.
Well, Asante, for this being such a great storyteller and a great guest on Unreserved Immigrant. It was a pleasure.
Thanks to you, Pumza. This was very therapeutic for me. Thank you so much for doing this.
Ha! That is the end of our episode.
If you enjoyed this podcast, remember to subscribe and share. If you would like Sniper Wolf Media to tell your story, or perhaps you'd like to donate or partner with us, please send an email to janice@sniperwolfmedia.co.za. We would love to tell your story.